John Rubino, curator of the Rubino Substack. How are you? Thanks for joining me today. Welcome to The Competent Investor.
Hey, Tom, great to talk to you again, and congratulations on the new show. I look forward to watching it grow dramatically.
Thank you, sir. As always, I'm very humbled by the support and grateful to have excellent guests like yourself to help me share this information and continue helping to teach people, keep people abreast of what's going on. And I couldn't do it without wonderful people like yourself.
All good.
So, John, we're chatting here on the, let's say, midday here on October 30th. Of course, yesterday was the Fed day. They lowered rates by 25 basis points. But the real turmoil at this point seems to be around Powell not committing to a December rate cut. Do you think that this is, you know, a major controversy, considering this is still probably somewhere around a month away, just over a month away, and that there's a lot of data that needs to come in between now and then?
Yeah, I think nothing that is a month from now is pressing at all, because so much is going to happen in the next 4 weeks. If it's like the last four, or the four before that, or the four before that. So, you know, it can be a world of difference for the Fed by that time. And then whatever they said leading up to it isn't going to mean anything. So, no, I think it's really interesting and scary that the Fed is cutting interest rates at all in the face of a stock market bubble. I mean, did you see Nvidia just lately? It's now a $5 trillion market cap stock, which means it's about as big as California's economy. And you know, the rest of the big indexes in the U.S., mostly because of a handful of tech stocks, are at record highs. House prices are as high as they've ever been. All kinds of other things are going on out there that that would seem to call for higher interest rates instead of lower interest rates. And yet we got the Fed cutting interest rates dramatically. And I think it was Steve Bannon. I was walking my dog and playing a YouTube video, and I think they had Steve Bannon on, and he was saying that he thinks the Fed should cut by 300 basis points. And he's fairly influential in MAGA circles. And Trump, of course, as a real estate guy, loves lower interest rates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another quarter point increase or cut in interest rates a month from now is not going to be very consequential, and it's not going to satisfy anybody. So I think the process of easing aggressively is kind of baked into the cake here, because let's say this stock bubble finally bursts. Well, what will that do? It'll make the Fed cut even more aggressively. You know, so I think they're going to cut rates regardless. If things are just like they are right now, they're still going to be under political pressure to ease. And if some bubbles start bursting, then you're going to see massive pressure on the Fed to cut. So I think there's a decent chance that we end up with dramatically lower short-term interest rates a year hence. Now, long-term interest rates is a whole different thing, because that's the bond market at work, and bond investors have to assume they're going to get a reasonable return on their bonds when they lend money in that way. And if you've got an aggressively cutting Fed with the government running massive deficits at the same time, that might spook the bond markets. So lower short-term interest rates might give us higher long-term interest rates, which is a massive crisis in its own right. So in other words, you know, to answer this question with basically one sentence, we have chaos ahead of us. And interest rates can do all kinds of things in the kinds of chaos that we're likely to see, given deficits and current inflation rates and current prices of financial assets. So I wouldn't even come close to presuming to having a specific prediction about where we'll be 6 months from now or a year from now, because this is just all too chaotic. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm basically a gold bug and a silver stacker because of that, because I can't predict anything that's going to come. And because of that, stability looms large. It becomes the most valuable thing out there. So, you know, some people buy volatility and they want to trade it. And I'm the opposite. I would buy stability with real assets that governments can't just create more of and inflate them away. And in that way, try to get through this in reasonably good shape with some capital intact.
John, as you're explaining why the Fed maybe shouldn't be cutting rates, this looming stock market bubble. On the other side of this, we see record credit card delinquencies, record layoffs, new home prices sliding, way more sellers than buyers in the housing market, and leverage in the stock market versus money supply at crazy imbalances. All of this seems to point towards more of a recessionary type of environment rather than a interest rate environment where we need to be cutting. Does all of this together, all of these cross currents, taking, aside from the first couple that we talked about, does this more so point to a recession that is being maybe ignored or not reported, just like the ugly jobs reports?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of recessionary types of indicators out there right now, and you named some of them, and there's other ones, which is part of the chaos of our situation right now, because you've got boom indicators. We've still got financial bubbles going on. At the same time, the economy seems to be weakening. So historically, the Fed doesn't try to continue to inflate bubbles. Usually they inflate them until they pop, and then they try to stop them from destroying the economy. But now we're actively trying to keep some massive financial bubbles going, and we're doing it in the face of, well, the bubbles themselves, but also, like you said, a lot of recessionary indicators, which means I don't know what it means. It means that we're heading into times that are just incredibly hard to predict, because if we were to raise interest rates to try to rein in these bubbles, because they represent massive inflation and a devaluation of the dollar relative to these bubble assets. So if you tried to intervene to stop that, you would blow up the financial sector and get a huge crisis. But on the other hand, if you lean against these recessionary trends that you mentioned, with easier money, then that makes these bubbles even bigger, and it makes the trauma of them bursting even more serious when that happens. Think about it. If we're kind of sliding into a recession, but not a violent one, things are just kind of slowing down, but then some giant stock index just crashes, drops by 30% in a couple of weeks, like the NASDAQ could easily do right now. Then that turns a slow drift into a modest recession, into potentially a 1930s style deflationary depression. We're creating the conditions where those are becoming our choices, and there's no pain-free way out of this at this point. I'd go as far as saying that I think this is the death spiral of the fiat currency experiment, and that we've reached basically the end of it, where we don't have good choices anymore. So our only choices have basically boiled down now to a deflationary crash, a la 1930s, or some kind of hyperinflation currency crisis that forces us to do a currency reset. And I think the latter scenario is way more likely, because we no nobody voluntarily chooses a 1930s style depression, but people with a monetary printing press will always choose more inflation, because it's not immediate. It might get them through the next year, in which case they get to retire, with their reputation intact. So they'll always choose that possibility over a guaranteed crash where you're the Herbert Hoover of this generation. So I think that's where we're headed, is we're going to inflate this thing until it blows up, and then we're going to do a currency reset. Or if we're way smarter than we seem at the moment, we'll do the currency reset in anticipation. You just on a Sunday night declare that you're back on a gold standard or something like that. And that would be by far the least painful way to do it, although it would still be painful. But nobody in charge of any major government has shown that kind of intelligence so far. So I wouldn't expect it to happen unless there's some people sitting around Trump's conference table when they're making these decisions who is more clear-sighted than they seem right now. So we'll see. But it all comes back to how you are going to defend yourself from this as an individual, right? It's basically an investment thesis. Everything we're talking about here is okay. Chaos. It's coming. What do you do? How do you protect your family from something like this? Because we can't do anything about it politically, right? You and I, our votes count, kind of, sort of, but they aren't going to stop the institutional momentum of this thing. We are headed off that cliff regardless, because there's nobody in sight who, if we install them into the presidency, would be able to cut government spending by $3 trillion a year to get us back into surplus to start paying off our debts. There's no way that happens. So, the only thing that's left is to just keep inflating as long as we can, and then hope that the monetary reset doesn't blow up the world. And who knows? I from an economics nerd standpoint, this is the most fascinating time in financial history, but I think for everybody else, it's going to be chaos and terrifying. And any bad word you can think of will apply in some way to what comes from all this.
Well, I think the only, let's say, interesting hope there is, and I think you could, in some ways, kind of be a de facto gold backing to currencies, which kind of suits, let's say, China and the US, obviously the two biggest powers, Russia as well. But it seems that they need, let's say, less help with their debt and or currency from, or as I understand that, I don't want to say that I'm any authority on that, but a higher gold price or a dramatically higher gold price from here, let's say 15, 20,000, and again, I don't want to say that as a target, but that would suit China and the US in a lot of ways to be able to have some leeway to be able to address some of these issues, don't you think?
I think a soaring gold price is the same thing as saying a collapsing currency. So, if gold goes to $15,000 an ounce, that kind of implies a world where other things are way up too, and that's inflation, and that inflation is really destabilizing. So, I don't think we get to $15,000 an ounce gold organically via market forces without it being incredibly chaotic. It'll bring a lot of political turmoil with it. But Russia and China are anticipating this by loading up on gold. So yeah, let the price of it go up. That's somewhat destabilizing from a currency standpoint, but it also makes everybody richer in their country. China in particular is encouraging their people. They're not, their central bank is buying gold, but they're encouraging Chinese people to load up on gold too. And India culturally has been, they've been buying gold and silver jewelry to give as wedding gifts since the beginning of their civilization. And they're incredibly rich when you look at it that way. They've got a ton of real money sitting around in the form of gold and silver jewelry. So that rising gold price makes different cultures differently rich. And it definitely helps the guys who have been loading up on gold and silver for the last decade or 1,000 years or whatever your culture has been doing. And so it helps the BRICS countries in particular. It helps Russia, China, and in India and several other countries who have been doing this. And it gives them a chance to do the currency reset in a relatively pain-free way. By just bringing out that BRICS currency that's linked to gold and that they can all trade with each other with, something like that, might be almost literally pain-free for those guys. For the US, it's tougher because we've got the world's reserve currency. And there's just so many dollars out there and so many people depend on dollars. And when we start debasing the dollar in a really aggressive way, which is the only way we get out from under all this debt, it becomes a huge problem for the rest of the world. You know, that we said that once. I think it was John Connolly back in the 1970s, who was the Treasury Secretary for Richard Nixon, the last time we were aggressively inflating the dollar away. And he said, well, it's our currency, but it's your problem to the rest of the world. And we might not be brazen enough to say that, but we'll create the conditions in which it's true if it goes that way. So anyhow, gold probably ends up getting to $15,000 an ounce. And it's just a question of how it happens. If it's chaotically through market forces, or if it's through governments going back to a gold standard and, you know, naming 15,000 as the price of gold relative to their currencies. The guys who run the numbers to figure out where the U.S. would have to price gold in order to back the dollar by like 40%, which is how it was in previous gold standards. They say it's $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 an ounce. So, you know, it could be a really big number when the time comes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, barring some kind of confiscation, it's going to leave the U.S. and the rest of the world with a lot of rich stackers out there. You know, the gold bugs will inherit the earth in that kind of a situation. So, and it, you know, there's that. That's really the upside to all this, is that the right people are going to have a lot of capital when the time comes. The people who are smart enough to see the chaos coming and take some steps to avoid it. And so, you know, then we will have the capital to help rebuild the system afterwards and protect our families. Mm-hmm. So, it won't seem, you know, that'll seem like kind of a small thing when the time comes, because the rest of the world will be so chaotic, but it'll be something.
Well, you bring up a really important point, and that is to the other side of the coin, really, is this idea that we don't necessarily know or will like the world when we see a $15,000 gold price. You know, that is a very chaotic situation because of what that means in all of these other markets. And it's a really important point to highlight and underscore, because it doesn't just mean that people that have bought gold or silver are going to be wealthy. It also means chaos for many, many millions of other people. Jono,
yeah, this is going to be a really messy world. And you just hope you have the savings and the capital to get yourself through. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to something we were talking about, particularly in NVIDIA and some of these AI type focused stocks, whether it's AMD or I believe it was OpenAI. You recently wrote this article talking about how some of the revenue could be being faked. How do you look at that situation, and how are they possibly able to do that, if that is in case what they are doing?
Well, there's this concept in business called vendor financing, which is where if you make something, you lend some money to your customer, who then buys whatever you're making, and then you book that as sales and profits. And it works just fine as long as your customer can continue to pay off the loan that you've made to them, right? But as soon as they default on the loan, then that money moves from your balance sheet, where you had it as an asset, to your income statement, where you're taking a massive loss. And something like that is happening right now in the AI world, where, for instance, NVIDIA gives OpenAI $100 billion, and then OpenAI turns around and builds a bunch of data centers with NVIDIA chips, and NVIDIA marks that as a profit, sales and profit, and then OpenAI has to be able to actually turn a profit of its own on all of those data centers, or the money that NVIDIA gave them is going to come back to haunt NVIDIA. And so you got this daisy chain now of lots of different entities in the AI world doing things like that with each other, where the money just goes from one to another, and it comes back around to the original lender or original investor. And it's not clear where the profit is being created that is going to pay off all of these loans that are out there and all of these investments. And you know, if one of these guys gets into trouble, then that kind of lays bare all the other ghost liabilities that the rest of the sector might have. And then the bubble bursts, right? Because if maybe you're making money on your AI that you're building, but you have all this other money lent out or invested, and it evaporates because some other entity that you lent the money to or invested in blows up, then all of a sudden you're not worth nearly what your profitability looked like it would make you be worth. And so everybody sells your stock and you tank, and then everybody else in the sector tanks. That's very possible when you've got a daisy chain of vendor financing going on. And that's what's happening now. I'm not predicting that it will happen in AI because it's really hard to say who makes what kind of money out of these things as it goes on, because so much of it is brand new. You know, it's absolutely new in human history. We've never had these kinds of technologies. We've never seen how they might affect businesses in terms of productivity or new products or whatever. And so we don't know how it's going to play out. But they're creating a lot of unnecessary risk right now, and it really could come back to bite them, and then by implication, crash the Nasdaq, and by implication, crash the economy, et cetera, et cetera. So we're kind of back to in the 1990s when the dot-com bubble really got going. People used to say things like the global economy depends on the U.S. stock market, and the U.S. or on the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy depends on the U.S. stock market, and the U.S. econ or in the U.S. stock market depends on five stocks, none of which are making any money. You know, and it turned out to be correct. That was the dynamic, and the crash in 1980 was pretty brutal when it happened. So we've got the same kind of thing going now with AI, and we don't know if it's going to work out the same way, but we're creating risks that are similar to what we had back in the day, the last time there was a giant tech bubble that burst. So I've been looking at the Nasdaq as a short candidate for a couple of years now, and I've been wrong that whole time, but I still see it the same way. You know, it looks like the kind of thing you really ought to be short right now. And you
Or
know,
ready to
don't
be
do it with
short.
re I mean, I thought it was ready to be shorted 2 years ago, and it's gone up since then. So don't do a lot of really aggressive stuff with it right this minute. But it's the kind of thing that if you've got that kind of risk tolerance, you know, if you can put a bet on against a big stock index with, say, long-dated put options, something like that, then there will come a time, very probably based on history, where that was a life-changing bet. You know, we'll look back and go, oh, I should have mortgaged the house and bought long-dated puts on the Nasdaq on this date, you know? And we just don't know what that date is, but we know that date is out there somewhere. And you know, it's hard not to participate in that kind of a big short scenario, just because with options, when you're really right, you're really, really right. You know, you can make multiples of what you put into a well-chosen option position. And the thing is, you have to do it in a timely way. You can't do it 3 or 4 years before the thing finally bursts, because then your option expires worthless. But you know, if you buy put options 6 months before the crash that you're anticipating happens, you make a ton of money. And I had that kind of a formative experience when the real estate bubble burst in the 2000s. You know, I put on basically the same bet as you see in the movie The Big Short, and it didn't work, and it didn't work, and it didn't work, and then finally it worked. So now I'm addicted to the feeling of having that work, and I want to replicate it. I want that thing to happen again. So I'm probably more willing to buy long dated puts than a normal person would be. So anyhow, yeah, don't do that with the rent money, but maybe do it with 5% of your net worth when the rest of your net worth is pretty conservatively invested, something like that.
So was that in like mortgage-backed securities or something like that?
No, you know, the whole that was one of the weird things about the Big Short, and the guys who were profiled in it, is they designed these instruments called credit default swaps. They designed
The
credit default
CDOs.
swaps. And use those as their vehicle to bet against the housing market. But really, all you had to do was short the home builders or the big banks, you know. And that's what I did. I just bought long-dated puts on Citigroup and on General Motors, actually, too. I think that's when they went bankrupt. I think I was short General Motors when they went bankrupt. You know, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and if you were really lucky, Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers and the home builders, you know, and just you don't have to do any really aggressive analysis about what the stock might ultimately be worth. Just short it at 75 and plan to close your short out at 10, you know, and that literally happened back then. You know, that's how far those things fell. And that's how far up the put options went. So you didn't have to do the exotic stuff they did in the big short. You have plenty of instruments out there that allow you to short broad parts of the economy. And it's you can also do that with you know, with options on specific stocks, but that is more aggressive because that means not only do you have to be right conceptually, but you have to be right about a specific stock that might be like bought out while you're waiting or something. But if you go against a sector, then or a broad index, then the odds of you being right, even if not that spectacularly right, are higher. So it's an easier bet to sleep with when you've put it on.
Well, before we get to that, let's say piece or that situation where we are able to be placing successful put options, the narrowness of this AI bubble and how it's being valued seems like a very difficult thing to be able to analyze or to get a real grasp of. Do you think that at this point we're in a crack up boom already, considering how narrow this performance is in these indices?
I think it's possible we'll look back on this as the beginning of a crack-up boom because, you know, tech stocks obviously are just being bought at levels that don't make any sense financially unless you assume a really different world out into the future. But they're not alone. You know, houses are as expensive as they've ever been. In a few cities, they're down a little bit, but mostly, you know, the Case-Shiller National Home Price Index is still going up to levels that are just crazy, much higher than they were during the actual housing bubble of the two or yeah the 2000s. And you know, you've got a lot of other things going on out there that could be attributed to way too much money chasing too few things. So yeah, I think we're close. Oh, government bonds, of course, are way overvalued based on the financial strength of the governments issuing those bonds. So, you know, so you've got multiple bubbles. And the question is the everything bubble by definition the same thing as a crack-up boom? And I think we'll look back on this very possibly and we'll start using those terms interchangeably because although it has to go a lot further from here, you know, let the world's major fiat currencies really just start to fall off a cliff, and then the price of everything goes up, and that's the later stage of the crack-up boom. You know, this is the relatively early stage when you've got tech stocks for sure, housing probably, and government bonds almost certainly in historic bubbles, and maybe that's enough for us to look back on it and call it a crack-up boom. We'll have to see, but you know, the general idea of currencies being devalued at an accelerating rate until people lose faith in them, which is basically what a crack-up boom is. We just give up on the currency. And you know, what is $4,000 gold if not people to an extent giving up on the dollar? And what is silver at you know, 50 bucks with a bullet, you know, soon to be 100 bucks? What is that if not kind of sort of a crack-up boom? So we'll see, but I think the answer is a qualified yes to your question.
You know, John, if it were only those, let's say those indices that were showing problems, that would maybe be one thing. But, we talked about this other, the other side of it, of credit card delinquencies, of course, the housing market. And this is also seems to be kind of showing, let's say, some smoke, and you tell me if you see fire here, but also in the, let's say, the plumbing of the repo market here. We've seen a couple announcements from the Fed that were kind of muted, and also a big extension of, let's say, credit or liquidity to the repo market. Do you see any smoke or fire there?
Oh yeah, governments having to bail out their banking systems are huge red flags for a gigantic financial crisis coming in. Here's what's happening now with the repo market. We have kind of sort of a shadow banking system in the U.S., which is made up of non-bank entities that behave by like banks. You know, they lend money, but just without the kind of banking regulation that banks do it within. There, it's huge now. You know, if you look at just private equity, apparently there are more private equity firms now than McDonald's in the United States. You know, there is a lot of dark money flowing around out there, and some of it is starting to blow up. You had a few big bankruptcies in that space just lately, and it turns out a lot of the related paper was on the balance sheet of some local and regional banks. So you kind of get what we had a couple of years ago when Silicon Valley Bank blew up, and everybody was worried that it would spread. Well, it's sort of the same thing is happening now, where you've got some, you know, local and regional banks having to report losses on stuff that nobody even knew they were investing in, like subprime auto loans, stuff like that. And then that spooks the depositors of those banks who pull their deposits out, which crashes those banks. And then the government steps in and bails out those banks to keep the whole sector from needing a bailout. But maybe it's too late. They have to, you know, at least be willing to bail out the whole sector. And then that spooks the rest of the markets, who see the government having to come up with another $3 trillion to bail out this sector, and they wonder what that means for the dollar, and then the dollar starts to lose value, and then there you are, you're in the currency crisis that ends the fiat currency experiment. So we're kind of in the early stages of that too, where the shadow banking system is very messy, and it's starting to blow up. And we don't know how bad it's going to be, but it potentially could be really bad, just because there are so many entities out there that we don't understand doing things that we don't understand. And it could be much bigger than it is right now, and it could be much scarier. So yeah, that might be one of the catalysts that kick off the final stage of this process. We don't know. There's a lot of possible catalysts. You know, tech stocks could tank, but also shadow banks could start blowing up and take the rest of the banking system with them.
So when we combine that understanding, John, with the idea that the Fed has now, run off its balance sheet, does this kind of bring us back into the era of quantitative easing?
Oh, it will have to do quantitative easing when there's a catalyst for it. In other words, if stocks tank, or if there's a recession, or if there's a recession which tanks stocks, the government will have to step back in with some kind of really aggressive easing. And if long-term interest rates are going up because everybody's afraid of what the bond market is going to do, you know, what happens to bonds when the Fed starts easing at the short end, then the government has to step in with yield curve control. In other words, they'll have to start buying long-term bonds to force down the price of those bonds, or force down the yield on those bonds. And that is quantitative easing. You know, that's what we did last time around, and we'll do it again this time around. But it's going to have to be on a bigger scale. You know, last time around was crazy big, but this time around is going to be much bigger, and it'll probably be combined with buying equities. The U.S. didn't buy, for instance, the S&P 500 in the 2000s, in 2010s, but the Japanese central bank did. They owned what? Most of their bond market and a third of their stock market at one point. I'm pulling those numbers out of thin air, but it's something like that. Well, this time around, we'll probably have to do that again in the U.S., where they step in and start buying stocks, which we're kind of already doing that. You know, the U.S. is starting to act like a hedge fund, where they're taking positions in critical companies and things like that. Well, more and more companies will be deemed critical when the next crisis really gets going. And so the government will feel like it has no choice but to step in with newly created dollars, buy tons of long-term treasuries, tons of asset-backed bonds, and the S&P 500 stocks. You know, and that's crazy. You should never have a government do things like that. They should never be buying private sector debt, and they should absolutely never be buying equities. That just totally screws up the way the price signaling mechanism of capitalism works. Because,
especially
you know,
when
capitalism is.
I was going to say, especially when, you know, there's such a speculative driven fever already existing in this market.
Yeah, we're already screwing up the price signaling mechanism by having the government run massive deficits and just flood the system with cash. And if the government is stepping in and becoming the buyer of last resort for Exxon and Intel and Cisco and Google, then we have no idea what those companies are actually worth, because the government is picking an artificially high price in order to support those companies. And so nobody knows how to allocate capital. And that's what really extreme government intervention does. It destroys the point of markets. Markets aren't just there for us to have fun with and for us to manipulate to get rich. They're there to send signals to capital allocators about where to invest and where not to invest. And if you take that away, then capitalism ceases to exist. You basically just have this this frantic dash for cash with no idea of what anything is worth. And eventually the Mao investment that flows from that, in other words, the bad ideas that get funded, start blowing up, and then you know, then the economy is, well, the economy is like 2000s economy when in 1999 tech stocks peaked and nobody knew what anything was worth, and then you had this big crash because you know, was Amazon worth $100 a share or $2 a share? You could not know that because the market was so flooded with outside cash that valuation was meaningless. Well, we're kind of headed for something like that again. I mean, we're already there in AI, and the government is kind of moving us there in critical minerals by investing really aggressively with dollars that are just made up out of thin air. And you know, the further we get into that, the less capitalist we become and the dumber we become as asset or as capital allocators. And once that happens, you know, there's no way to avoid wiping out all those bad investment decisions via default, right? And so you get a huge crash. It gets bigger the longer this goes on, and that's kind of what I'm afraid of happening in the next crisis, is that we just decide valuation doesn't matter. We're just using dollars created out of thin air to support big employers. So because we don't want those people to be laid off, because they will vote against us in the next election. And when that happens, then, you know, it's over for a capitalist world. And you know, it's just a living hell for an awful lot of people. And unlimited wealth for a handful of people who see it coming and know how to play it.
So John, on the other side of this, can you give us some perspective on, you know, the current precious metals bull market and how much of a, let's say, a blip you see this current pullback? You know, we're just, I think we saw peak to trough, something like 10.5% in and around there for gold pullback. Is that a, let's say, a normal consolidation period in a hot bull market like this?
Yeah, the gold and silver story is very simple. Those are the old kinds of money that have held their value for 3,000 years. And that's where we hide out when we don't trust the currency managers of whatever money the country's government is using right now. So we pile back into gold and silver when we're afraid of inflation or debasement. And that's why gold and silver are going up right now, because we're afraid of what's happening to the world's big currencies. So that's super simple, easy to understand, and that we had a big correction right now is completely natural because gold and then silver had huge runs. You know, gold was bumping up against $2,000 an ounce for like 3 years there, and then it finally blew through $2,000 an ounce, and then it blew through $3,000 an ounce, and then $4,000 an ounce without any real resistance. And you would think that big round numbers like 3,000 and 4,000 would just be stacked with people ready to sell.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the case. You know, gold just kept on going up. And so finally, people had enough profits to protect that they decided to take a little bit of money off the table. You know, when gold was $4,100 an ounce, that means that going back 3,000 years, everybody who bought gold had a profit to protect. You know, and so it's no surprise that a lot of people sold at that point. And it's also no surprise that some governments decided to jump into precious metals and try to manipulate those monies down a little bit, because when they go up like that aggressively, it makes the big currencies look bad. So you had people who had bought along the way up selling, and you had governments manipulating the market via futures contracts and stuff like that. And so you had a reasonable correction, completely to be expected, not scary in any way, and something where, you know, as long as you know you're in a bull market, buying the dip is what you should be doing. And it's been that way with equities for a really long time. The people who bought all the corrections and all the bear markets ended up making money in the end. And I think it's the same way with precious metals now. We've got a long, long bull market here. As long as governments are overspending and overborrowing, and in that way debasing their currencies, then capital will flow into gold and silver, because that's where you hide out in that kind of a situation. So yeah, the correction that we're having now is normal, natural, and healthy, and we should treat it as a buying opportunity, although I don't know where it ends. You know, I don't know what the bottom of this correction is. Maybe we're already there. Maybe gold has to drop a lot further, but either way, it'll make gold-related things cheaper. And let's say you're buying gold mining stocks, you know, that gives you a chance to put in some low-ball bids just to see. You might get a chance to buy Agnico Eagle for 20 bucks lower than today or something like that. And in the long run, that's a very good thing. So don't be spooked by this, because, you know, corrections in bear markets, basically that is their function. It's to shake weak hands out of the market and put the asset into strong hands who have no intention of selling at the current price. And that process is going on now in precious metals and to an extent the mining stocks. So don't let yourself be shaken out. You know, it's reasonable to be the one taking some profit after a nice long run like this, but don't be spooked completely out of this market, because you know, until we have the currency reset, the bull market for gold and silver is not over. So you want to stay with it while it's in its, let's say it's in the third or fourth inning of a long baseball game right now. There's no reason to get out now. Taking a little bit of profits here and there, that's fine, but don't bail completely and then move on to something else. This should still be a core holding for people whose main focus is the giant financial crisis that's coming our way.
You know, as we talk about buying the dip and how long it might last or how deep it might go, I've seen some interesting reports that, and I don't know, I haven't been able to corroborate them yet, but I saw a tweet earlier today that said that Saudi Arabia bought several billion dollars worth, as well as one of the other sovereigns. I also was speaking with a bullion dealer recently that said that he has a couple tens of millions of dollars worth of silver orders sitting on his order book or order desk to try and bottom pick this particular pullback. So, you know, all indications from what I have seen and read, again, not completely confirmed, are that it is being bought aggressively. So it should be interesting to see how quickly this rebounds. But
the physical silver story is a really big part of this, because silver is an industrial metal besides being a monetary metal. And the US, along with a lot of other governments, have decided silver is a critical mineral, right? And so there's a lot of buying going on out there that seems to be depleting the physical stock of silver that's on the exchanges. And if we see a default on an exchange where they say, okay, we'll pay you cash for your futures contract, but we won't let you take delivery of the silver that you're entitled to do, that will send silver through the roof. So we should be looking for that as a real possibility here that gives it massive upside potential. Sorry to interrupt, but that's an important part of the silver story.
Well, it absolutely is. So on the other side of that, John, though, you mentioned the mining stocks. You recently wrote another article as well about basically the problem, or the problem as the market saw it with Newmont's earnings. They've doubled their earnings year over year, so third quarter last year to third quarter this year, and yet their share price dropped by 5%. So do you think that is a buy the rumor, sell the news type event? Is this people profit taking? You know, how do you see that?
Well, I think that a company like Newmont is really healthy financially now because they're selling something that has appreciated dramatically, and so they're generating a lot of cash flow on their production, and they're using that cash flow to improve themselves either by paying off debt or raising their dividend or buying back equity, whatever. You know, they're doing good things with their cash flow. But the reason the stock dropped is that their production guidance wasn't as aggressive as people were hoping that it would be. And that's a big problem for the big miners. And it's a great situation for the smaller miners because the big guys just cannot seem to find enough new resources to grow their production. So they're producing lots of gold and silver and they're making lots of money on what they're producing, but they're not producing more ounces each year, which is what you really want in a growth profile stock, right? And so what they're going to do, so people sold Newmont based on the prospect of only the same number of ounces next year as this year. But what that means is a big company like Newmont that has tons of cash to throw around is just going to go out and buy reserves by picking up the junior producers and the advanced explorers who have outlined pretty good resources. You know, so if you've got a deposit that's big enough to move the needle for an entity like Newmont, they're going to be sniffing around and they're going to be talking big numbers for you because that's one way for them to solve that problem. You know, if they just take some of their free cash and they buy the capacity to increase their production dramatically over the next 5 years, then all of a sudden investors will like them again, right? All of a sudden, the last piece of their puzzle is in place, and they're not just a solid miner, they're a growth stock that's going to generate increases in capital or in free cash flow for 5 years, which is basically as far as the eye can see from a momentum investor standpoint. So easy fix for somebody like Newmont and a nice high premium takeout for the stocks that they're going to be buying. So that's a good thing for the junior miners for sure. You know, if you've got a really high quality, for instance, explorer that is is outlining a very big, maybe a tier one mine or something like that, prepare to say goodbye to it because somebody's going to come in and just scoop it right up in the next couple of years. And you won't get the 10 bagger effect that you would have gotten if the thing had time to run, but they'll buy you out for two or three times today's price, which, you know, you can't sneeze at that. You can't think it's a bad thing, even though you wish you would have had more time for this thing to play out. But I don't think that's going to be the case in this market. I think a lot of high quality smaller miners are going to get bought out in the next couple of years because of the situation that Newmont is in.
John, do you think this kind of creates a situation where we could see all of a sudden, let's say, Wall Street money start to recognize the cash flow of this sector, recognize what's happening here, and instead of pile into the big, let's say, blue chip names, see the momentum that's starting to gather in the M&A sector and move into the smaller names instead of the bigger names once this recognition starts to take hold?
Yeah, well, generalist money usually flows into the big names in the space first because that's what they recognize, you know, and that's what a financial planner, if you go to them and say, buy me a gold stock, well, they'll buy you know, Newmont or Agnico Eagle and maybe Barrick or something like that. And then as you're successful with those first few purchases, you start looking at what else is down there that that might go up even more. And then you get a serious broad-based bull market going. And we're in that phase now where yeah, lots of people bought the big miners and bought the big ETFs that own the big miners. And now they're looking around for something with a little bit more action because they're cocky. You know, they made some serious money. They think they know what they're doing in this space. And so they're going to start taking bigger chances with less well-known names. And usually in precious metals bull markets, you get like a year or two towards the end where the really crappy names are the best performers because they're very thinly traded, they're illiquid, and generalist money is buying them because they have gold or silver in their name. We're not there yet, but that is something that's probably coming the way this is going. You know, the big miners buy out the high quality smaller ones, and then generalist money starts pouring in to ride that acquisition wave by buying just basically anything in the space. So that's not a reason to go out and buy crappy names. You know, you always want to stay with quality, but it's just an amusing thing that happens towards the end of the cycle, and we're a ways away from that, but not that far. You know, let Newmont go out and make some big acquisitions, and that should do it.
So, John, why do you think, let's say, copper and gold make a good combination in a portfolio?
Because they're both great stories. Copper is the key to the electrification of the world. You got to have a way to transport the power that you're creating. You know, and uranium is another one like that that fits in the same kind of story where with AI, for instance, and electric cars and solar panels, et cetera, we have the need for a lot more electricity. And we're going to build as many power plants as we need to satisfy that need. And that's where uranium comes in. Lots of those plants are going to be nuclear, but we need then to transport that power to wherever it's being used, and that's copper. We need copper wiring. And some of the predictions are pretty crazy in the copper market. I have to kind of make up the numbers, but the general story is that we might need twice as much copper over the next couple of decades as has been mined in all of previous human history. It's a stat like that. And that means that if you've got a working copper mine that's going to produce for the next 20 years, then you're metaphorically sitting on a gold mine. You know, you're going to see the demand for what you're selling grow dramatically in a really open-ended way because there's no way to know when this whole process ends.
As
And
as
there
long
just
as you
aren't that.
can as long as you can get it permitted and into production.
Well, yes, exactly. It's got to be a legit copper mine, or where the government in the Latin American country where the mine is isn't going to just come in and close the thing down like with Cobre Panama. So there is there's a lot of risk associated with mining in general, and you know, the copper space is no exception. But if you've got one of the good ones, one of the mines in a jurisdiction where they're going to leave you alone and or take care of you, and you've got a really long life, low cost mine, then it's going to be really valuable. Or it is really valuable today, but it's going to be much, much more valuable going forward because there just isn't that much of such things out there. You know, we've spent 2,000 years looking for copper deposits, and we found the easy ones. So there are still some more out there, but they're, for whatever reason, not easy. You know, they're in a tough place, or the grade is low, and or there's some other metallurgical thing going on, and you know, it's just it's tougher to mine now than it used to be. And part of that, the reason for that is that we found the easy deposits. So now we're having to work a lot harder to get what used to be fairly easy to do. So if you've got one of the easy ones, if you've got a high quality mine in this space, you're going to tend to make a lot of money going forward. So that's part of the commodity complex thesis, is that the copper story is kind of replicated by a lot of other commodity stories out there where, yeah, okay, we're going to need this stuff, but there just isn't that much of it that's easily accessible. So we're going to pay way up to guarantee our supply. And so you want to be in the names that fall under the heading of guaranteed supply, and commodities have gone up a little bit lately, but compared to, for instance, the S&P 500, you compare the S&P 500 to a commodities index, it's no comparison. The stock market is much more expensive than commodities are right now. So commodities have a long way to run in general over the next decade or two. And you just got to make sure that you're in the right names if you're buying stocks. But another way to do this too is the physical ETFs, because now there's a physical ETF for most of the commodities out there, most of the really big commodities. You got one for uranium, you got a couple for silver, obviously for gold. There's one for copper that just got created by Sprott lately. And that's a place to start if you're building a commodities portfolio. You buy the physical ETFs as a way to participate in the increase in prices of those commodities without the mining risk. And then from there, you can go and look at the mining sector in a given commodity and see what the highest quality names are. And then from there, you work your way down as you learn more to less well-known names, and then you try to separate the wheat from the chaff and get yourself some equity positions that can be potentially 10 baggers. And that's the culmination of the process. You get a few 10 baggers towards the end, and then your wealth goes up exponentially, and you are officially a successful investor, and that's the kind of thing that happens towards the end with that last move into the 10 bagger space. And once you've experienced a couple of 10 baggers, it's very addictive. That's I think it ranks right up there with heroin or something for most people once they've experienced it. When you have, yeah, you remember Great Bear Resources,
I
which
interviewed
was
the
a
CEO a couple of years ago.
okay. See, that one is a good example of this, because that one went from 39 cents when I started watching it to like $24 a share. So
Incredible.
that was a something like a 50 bagger, right? Some crazy number like that. If you just got in, if you were got in early, and then you waited and waited, you let it play out without bailing on the way up, you ended up with just a crazy gain in that one position right there. Do that a few times, and that's life-changing money. But the problem is, you can't do that until you're really well versed in it. Because, at the time that Great Bear Resources was a 39 cent stock, it wasn't guaranteed in any way. You had to take kind of a leap of faith, and you had to understand the technical aspects of what made it a good bet. And you won't know that until you've been in the space for a lot of years. So those aren't the things that regular beginning investors can do, but they're the things that somebody like Rick Rule, who does just naturally, the guy's been doing it for 30 years or 40 years now. So to him, it's the most natural thing in the world to look at a set of drill results and actually have a good sense of what they mean. But for most people, it takes a while to build up that kind of expertise.
It absolutely does. And I think just to kind of retouch on one of those points, the physical ETFs, let's say, aren't a replacement for physical metal to begin with, right? Like that ends up being your foundation. And then from there, as you said, so elegantly that you, as you learn more, you kind of step into these, let's say, riskier arenas with correspondingly smaller pieces or percentages of your portfolio.
Well, yeah, the physical ETFs, you have to separate gold and silver from the rest of them, because with gold and silver, you can actually buy physical metal and
Exactly. Yeah.
store it yourself. So, but you can't do that with copper, obviously, because it's really cheap per pound. You would have to, you'd need, an entire barn size outbuilding and a whole bunch of earth moving equipment to move it in there. But and you can't do that with uranium because it's radioactive. So with those things, the closest you can get to physical is a physical ETF. With gold and silver, obviously, you want to start with it in hand, in part because it's so cool to have that much silver. If you have a decent amount of silver, you've got this pile of gorgeous coins. See, I'm betraying my obsession now. I'm kind of a miser when it comes to this stuff. Was it Donald Duck who had an uncle who was a miser, and he'd stack his stuff on the table and everything and look at it and fondle it. I kind of do that with silver coins and sometimes with gold coins. So that's one of the advantages, besides having total control over it, of owning physical metal yourself. Because you get to decide where it's stored, and you get to access it when you really need to. And you can't do that with copper under any circumstances, and certainly not uranium. So those are different things. But that doesn't mean gold and silver physical ETFs aren't a good thing to own. It means it's just the second step in the process instead of the first step. So with gold and silver, you buy the physical, have it delivered to you, and then you buy an ETF, a physical ETF, and then you buy high quality mining stocks and so on. But yeah, there's basically a lifetime worth of steps for a gold bug to go through before they get to the end of the process where they're buying, 15 cent a share explorers from Tanzania or someplace.
John, on the other side of this, we're seeing uranium catch a really good bid. We're seeing copper catch a really good bid, and obviously the precious metals. On the other side of it, though, we're seeing the oil price just kind of languish and in a lot of ways grind a little bit lower, sideways to lower. How do you look at the price of energy and how that's kind of playing into the entire dynamic right now? In some ways, to me, that signals that the world economy might be a little bit weaker than we otherwise imagine it to be. Do you see this actually as a potential buying opportunity for some of the service companies?
Well, I think oil stocks are a good thing to own because they tend to have good financials. They sometimes pay good dividends, and we're going to continue to use oil for as far as the eye can see. But the fundamentals of oil are a little bit bearish at times because we're able to produce a lot of it. Where the peak oil didn't happen, we're able to drill still and find deposits and pump it out. And we're also producing a lot of natural gas, and natural gas is turning out to be an oil replacement in some ways. You can refine it into some of the same things you refine oil into. And so an increase in the natural gas supply is sort of kind of the same thing as an increase in the oil supply. So we don't have any kind of a shortage in that market. The dynamic where we're just going to run out of copper, there's nothing like that in oil. We're going to have enough oil and gas going forward to be able to satisfy our needs basically forever, or at least until things in the energy market change really dramatically, like nuclear fusion or something like that. But and so that means that you probably don't get the kind of parabolic run because of fundamentals in the oil market and the gas market that you might get in copper or uranium, where we just don't have enough, and we got to pay up to get what we need. So I still think something like Exxon is a good dividend stock, right? Because they've raised their dividend for a lot of years in a row, and they have good cash flow right now, and they have solid properties that are going to continue to produce. And so if you want a 3 or 4 or 5% dividend, that's a stock that is absolutely worth owning. And then some of the other really high quality oil companies, might still generate a lot of growth themselves because their properties are so high quality, and they might be, to an extent, growth stocks where they generate higher cash flow going forward, and that makes their stock worth more. So there's still money to be made in oil. It's just not the crazy great story that you see in gold and silver and uranium and copper, where it's just, you know, it's almost a sure thing, not a guaranteed thing, but very close to it.
But John, over time, don't you think this, let's say if oil stays at these prices where companies aren't necessarily that profitable, that this underinvestment in the exploration side ends up leading to a possible, maybe not a supply crunch, but a supply tightness?
Yeah, that's completely possible. Mm-hmm. But that could be met with a lot of new production.
Mm-hmm.
It just, there might be a little bit of lag. And, you know, a lot of people think oil companies have underinvested in the last decade anyhow, you know, because the governments were telling them they were going out of business. You know, we're going to electric
yeah.
cars. We're going to put you out of business. And, you know, first coal and then you guys. So they didn't invest as aggressively as they might have.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had invested more aggressively, the price of oil would be lower than it is right now. So, yeah, there can totally be supply and demand and production cycles out there. It's just that they don't seem to lead inexorably towards a crisis where that might be the case in, say, copper, where, you know, we just don't have enough of it. And maybe silver and gold in the monetary sense. You know, it's unlikely that you see oil because of fundamental factors going parabolic. I mean, there could be geopolitical things happen where we have a war in the Middle East, and that shuts off the supply of oil for a while, and that sends the price up to $150 a barrel. That's totally possible. And it's another reason to own good quality oil stocks, because they'll ride right along with that if it happens. But it's just not something that fundamentals point to in a really emphatic way.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I really appreciate you spending some time with me today to walk us through all of these different subjects and shine some light on these different topics. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up today?
We covered a lot of ground. So I'll just talk about my Substack then. I'm at rubino.substack.com, and I put out a newsletter there that looks for actionable advice for all of this stuff on the investing side, and then also for lifestyle and social things like that. So far, so good. It's turning out that there are to be a lot of actionable advice on subjects like that.
Well, and you've been quite successful. It seems like a lot of people like it as well, because you have quite a few subscribers on that, right?
Yeah, it's a real job, you know, and you never know what something like that's going to turn out to be. But it's turning out to be a nice community that's coalescing around those ideas, and it's working out for everybody.
Excellent. Well, John, like I said, I really appreciate your time today, and look forward to chatting with you again.
Thanks, Tom. Look forward to it.